You may have heard a few things about blackface lately. And by a few things, I mean a ceaseless parade of prominent politicians and celebrities and fashion brands facing criticism for what some of those headlines might mildly call the racially insensitive practice.
Over the weekend, Italian luxury brand Gucci was forced to apologize for selling this women's knit sweater, resembling blackface.
Calls tonight for Virginia's governor to resign because of this photo. One person in blackface, one in a Ku Klux Klan robe.
But it's racist because so truly, you do get in trouble if you are a white person who puts on blackface on Halloween, or a black person who puts on whiteface for Halloween. Okay, back when I was a kid, that was okay as long as you were dressing up as like a character.
This is Black History Month, and the modern tendency to treat blackface as an offensive kind of joke does not tell the story. In fact, you have to dig pretty deep into the history of racism in Western civilization to get to what's so insidious about blackface. So, we're going to do that, first of all, because it's fascinating and not widely understood, but also so that the next time someone wonders aloud why this is such a big deal, you've got an answer. I'm Jordan Heath Rawlings, and this is The Big Story. Andre Demise is a writer and podcaster. He is a podcaster here at Frequency Podcast Network on Black Tea and a writer at Maclean's, at the Globe and Mail, many other publications. Andre, how is Black History Month going?
It's not. I think we need to cancel this, reschedule it for June sometime, or maybe just put it off for a year. Just say, hey, listen, Black History Month is canceled this year. Let's try again in 2020.
What
See
happened?
If it goes any better. Man, I think where it kind of went off the rails was when Ralph Northam, the governor of Virginia, was discovered that there was a yearbook, not from high school, but during his medical school years, that had a picture of it was either him in blackface or him in KKK robes. It was one of the two. And somehow we ended up getting stuck on, well, it's probably him in blackface. And then he had to defend himself about whether or not blackface was offensive, or if he meant it offensively. He's like, oh, I've only ever done it once before, and that was to imitate Michael Jackson. It just, the whole thing went off the rails so quickly. And then
he almost moonwalked at that press conference.
At the press conference where he was explaining himself, a reporter asked him if he could moonwalk, and it looked like he was about to do it, and his wife gave him the stare of death.
Inappropriate circumstances.
My wife says inappropriate circumstances.
It was just case after case after case of somebody was, had been shown to have worn blackface in their high school or college yearbook. Or, some brand did something incredibly obscene and racist, like Gucci releases. It looked like a turtleneck, and it was black, and it had a big pair of red lips on it. Burberry releases, or they had models, walking down a catwalk, and in their hoodie, the drawstring on their hoodie was shaped like a noose. It's just been one thing after another. And I think we're just going to have to put the whole thing in jollof rice. Yeah.
What is blackface?
Blackface is a tradition that began, it was actually in the pre-Civil War era. There was an actor, a struggling white actor, his name is Thomas D. Rice, that essentially sold white people's preconception about the Negro back to them through popular entertainment. See, I think when people look at blackface, they assume that it's just white people who put on face paint and mock black people. Mm-hmm. And it's offensive, but, maybe we should get over it. And the thing is, it's not just an offensive stereotype. Blackface is actually one of the pillars of white supremacist thought during the pre-Civil War period, during the crescendo of abolitionist thought in America. And it wasn't just an American phenomenon. I mean, it caught on globally. So T.D. Rice, who was the first, I guess, widely known minstrel actor, his act caught on globally. He was popular not just in the United States and not just touring across the American Midwest and in the North as well, but he was coming to Canada, he was going to Great Britain, he was going to France. Everybody seemed to love this, and part of the reason was that even though in America you couldn't really create an enclave away from black people, especially in the slaveholding South. You in some ways rubbed elbows with them if you were of a certain class, but you never understood them. You never really got to know them because, segregation was in full effect, right? So you couldn't have relationships with black people. Even in the free North, while you may see black people in your day-to-day, again, especially if you're of a certain income class, you don't know who they are. What T.D. Rice did, and I think this was sort of like a brilliant con here, was that he took all of the scientific racism, all of the highfalutin concepts of ethnology and scientific racism and distilled them down into popular entertainment. So scientific racism, you know, especially in, again, the pre-Civil War period and all the way through the turn of the 20th century, as we get into the Jim Crow and segregation eras, what ethnologists, scientists, even medical professionals did was create a distinct class of human beings of which the Negro belonged to a subclass. So during the abolitionist era, you couldn't make the case for having people in bondage unless there was something about having those people free that was a danger to society.
Right.
And you saw that every, you know, if you look at ethnologists like de Gobineau, if you look at Hegel's work, if you look at the work of, you know, of French colonials who were essentially participating in the scramble for Africa, you saw this again and again, this idea that the Africans are a savage race. They denuded us of gender. They denuded us of every human characteristic except for lascivious sexuality. And all of that was on display in T.D. Rice's Blackface Act.
Describe for me one of his performances. What kinds of stuff would he do? What would it look like?
Okay, so there's a song called Jump Jim Crow, and there's a style of dancing called buck dancing. You know, and some, you know, sometimes when, you know, you see black people in popular culture now basically speaking against black culture or talking about pulling up your pants and putting on basically a performance for white audiences, people will call that cooning or they'll call it buck dancing. Mm-hmm. Buck dancing is an actual tradition, and he would imitate that in his minstrel shows. You know, he would sit around and eat watermelon and basically act like a grown yet unintelligent child. And that's pretty much how ethnologists described black people, is that we are grown and fully developed human beings, but we are not developed mentally. I'll go back to, for example, Dr. William Lee Howard in a 1903 essay in a journal he wrote in medicine. He says, and I quote, "The truth is that the Negro of today, untrammeled and free from control," and this is him describing what will happen or what has happened in
if black people are free.
But when black people were freed through the Emancipation Proclamation, this is what happened. "Free from control is rapidly showing atavistic tendencies," atavistic meaning that he's reverting back to his nature. So slavery was actually a refinement of the Negro, and without the yoke of slavery, the Negro reverts back to his natural tendencies. He's returning to a state of savagery, and in his frequent attacks of sexual madness, is himself savage. The innate character of the African will demonstrate itself more and more as he is allowed the liberty and his sway of ancestral sexual impulses. No amount, no education of training is going to change a non-existing element, that is, our intelligence. 1907, Dr. R.W. Schufelt. "In the Negro, all passions, emotions, and ambitions are almost wholly subservient to the sensual instinct." He's talking about our propensity to rape. "They copulate solely for the gratification of the passion, for the erotic pleasure it affords them. In other words, Negroes are purely animal, that is, in the sense of the quadrupedal animals in this respect." And that is what blackface and minstrelsy is meant to portray, those atavistic tendencies, that how different we are than refined white people. And there's a reason that I found this incredible, because it shows you the exact contrast here. There's a reason that in Ralph Northam's yearbook, you see somebody in blackface standing next to somebody in KKK robes. Mm-hmm. Because in the post-Civil War era and in the early 1900s, when lynching was sweeping across the United States, what the purpose of the KKK was to defend white honor, very specifically white women's honor. Mm-hmm. This is why in lynchings, the act of castration, not just the savaging of black flesh. So, you know, they would be shot, they would be stabbed, they would be beaten. There was a mortification of the flesh that was happening here. But castration figured into so many lynchings that it became pretty much synonymous, that black men's genitals were often mutilated, cut off, and taken as prizes. And there's so many examples of this. I mean, the fact that the KKK shows up alongside blackface existed here in Canada as well. You might remember a few years ago, I believe it was in Campbellford at a Legion Hall, that a couple of gentlemen showed up for a Halloween contest. And one of them showed up in blackface and the other one showed up in KKK robes. And the gentleman who's wearing the KKK robes had a rope around the man in blackface.
I do remember that. Yeah.
That always happens. And, you know, blackface has a very long and sordid tradition here in Canada as well. In the prairies, and I tweeted about this a few days ago, in the prairies, when black people were migrating out of the Midwest, both due to the Dust Bowl, and B, due to Jim Crow and segregation. When they were making their way to Alberta and the prairies, there were letters that were written both from Americans to Canada to say, well, if you allow them into your country, this is what's going to happen.
Mm-hmm.
But also to Canadians from the Daughters of the Empire to people working in Wilfrid Laurier's government that explained that if you allow black people to come into this country, they are not acclimated to the climate, but they're also not acclimated to hard work. And that's what's necessary here in the prairies. And what you're going to have is basically black men, lazy black men, raping their way across the prairies. And that's pretty much the story of blackface, popularizing not just a mockery of our looks, but essentially mainstreaming the idea that we are subhuman savages and making it consumable for people who don't read medical journals and aren't paying attention to ethnologists.
When did it and how did it become something seen as a fun joke for stupid people to put on for Halloween costumes or yearbook photos or whatever? How did it go from as intentionally abusive as it originally began to unintentionally abusive, ignorantly abusive? I don't do you know what I'm saying
though? Yeah. I think if I get you correctly here, when did it become, I think what you're saying here is, when did it go from mainstream to fringe? Like, when did it go from, popular culture to a secret joke that, rich white guys kiki about, in their yearbooks and medical journals, et cetera. Is that more or less what you're saying?
Yeah, or at least something that was accepted as not necessarily evil, but as parody.
Well, you start to see a decline of public incidences in the popularity of minstrel shows, I think, after spates during the civil rights era. So after, for example, like the Red Hook Summer, after the march from Montgomery to Selma, or someone in Montgomery, you begin to see a decline in the popularity because I think people's consciousness started to catch up with them. But it then becomes like an inside joke or a secret handshake among white people where they congregate together away from the presence of black folk. And I think for the most part, when you look at the academy and you look at some high schools in the United States, like the high school that I went to in Lake Worth, Florida, even though desegregation had fully taken effect, you didn't really start seeing black students coming to that school until the 70s.
Mm-hmm.
So in whites-only spaces, I think it just becomes sort of an inside joke. And to them, it was innocent, but they're still trafficking in those stereotypes. I personally didn't really see this becoming a popular Halloween thing until, I would say, probably like the late 90s, early 2000s. It begins to make a comeback. And I think in some ways it was some comedian's idea of subversive humor that helps it make a comeback. And I could be completely wrong on this, but in my lifetime, I just didn't begin to see it until the late 90s, early 2000s. And it now becomes an annual tradition for white people to dress up as blackface and then shrug their shoulders, put their hands up in the air and say, well, I had no idea that this was a problem.
Yeah.
I don't think it's racist. This idea of like innocence, this idea of this ignorance, this very precious mentality, like I had no idea that this was racist. And if I knew it was offensive, I wouldn't have done it. And I'm sorry. That is also a facet of white supremacy. The ability to separate yourself from your own history and to act like you never knew that this was a problem in the first place. I think I don't buy the act. Like, I don't buy that Ralph Northam didn't really know that this was racist. The Attorney General of Virginia, Mark Herring, admitted that he wore blackface. I believe it was he was trying to look like Curtis Blow. I think it was for a Halloween party. The idea that people don't know how offensive this is or what tradition it's seeped in, I don't buy it. I don't believe it. I think people are playing dumb here.
How do you think those people see themselves then? If you think they're playing dumb, they're aware that they're doing this to perpetuate white supremacy.
I don't think that they're doing it consciously to perpetuate white supremacy. I don't know if they think that they're white supremacists, and frankly, I don't really care.
Mm-hmm.
I think that that's just one of the ways that it operates. It's background radiation. It operates invisibly, and when people do things that they consider to be innocent and non-harmful, but do cause harm, and knowing how many conversations we've had about this over the last, I would say, like 6, 7, or 8 years, like they fully understand the gravity of it. And I think what it really comes down to is people don't take black people seriously when we say that this is dehumanizing. I think to some extent, and this is just my own speculation here, I think to some extent when black people say, this costume you're putting on dehumanizes me, they don't actually understand what the word dehumanize means. They think it means demean, or they think it means mock or insult, like our feelings are hurt. And it's not just hurting our feelings. It is creating the conditions by which you can pretty much do anything you want to the black body and not suffer consequences for it.
How do we grapple with people like Governor Northam, but also just there's been a ceaseless string of them? How do we grapple with the discussion that's to be had that we do hopefully understand these things better now that I didn't know? So I want to I want to read you Nicole Carroll, who is the editor-in-chief of USA Today. Yep. USA Today undertook a project after the Virginia scandal to go through high school yearbooks and try to figure out how prevalent this was.
I heard about that one. That was amazing.
And what they found was, unfortunately, and I'll quote from Nicole Carroll's article in USA Today, the 1988-89 yearbook I edited at Arizona State University included a photo of two people at a Halloween party dressed as Mike Tyson and Robin Givens. It is horrible, and of course the photo should not have been published. So the editor of USA Today started a project to figure out how prevalent blackface was and found out that she'd edited a yearbook featuring blackface. But she wrote an editorial sort of confronting the idea, and the key piece is here. Clearly the 21-year-old me who oversaw the book and that page didn't understand how offensive the photo was. I wish I had. Today's 51-year-old me, of course, understands and is crushed by this mistake and apologize publicly. And accountability, transparency, education, discussion, that's how we grow.
You know, that's funny because black people don't have to be educated on this. I mean, we understand it because it happens to us. Mm-hmm. It's interesting where the education or the need for education lies, you know, and it kind of shows you how deeply woven this aspect of white supremacy is in the culture, that she is a 21-year-old editor, didn't even notice it. Mm-hmm. Like maybe she noticed it, I don't know, but it showed up and she let it go anyway because it is so ensconced in white culture.
She had no memory of the photo.
No, it shows up and then it disappears. And I think that's why a lot of people are getting ambushed with these, you know, these old pictures that surface, et cetera, because they... And this is why, for example, you see like a Megyn Kelly defending it on NBC before she was canned.
What is racist? Because truly, you do get in trouble if you are a white person who puts on blackface on Halloween, or a black person who puts on whiteface for Halloween. Like when I was a kid, that was okay as long as you were dressing up as like a character.
Because it's a valued tradition. The idea of the black buck and the idea of the black mammy is so deeply embedded in white culture that, as a matter of fact, in the post-Civil War South, you know, there were monuments that were going to be made to mammies because white Southerners, especially rich white Southerners, were so inured to the idea of growing up with a black mammy in the household that they could never let go of it. And I think this is another aspect, is that blackface is so embedded in white culture that people are having growing pains in letting go of that stereotype. I don't think all of this is because, you know, our culture has changed and things are brand new and we're just adapting to this new PC culture. I think what we're seeing now is forcing people to let go of the images, stereotypes that they were steeped in throughout their childhood and formative years is painful for them to get rid of, even when it means that we die as a result of those stereotypes.
So I often play the ignorant white guy for you when you come on this podcast.
Are you just playing a role?
No. but I grew up with the knowledge that blackface was offensive, that it was... not to be done, that it was insulting, that it was racist. I didn't know most of the history of it that you just told me. And I think, and I'm not trying to paint myself as ignorant, I think there's a whole generation almost there that has been removed enough from it that they know it's bad, but they don't know why.
Are they removed though? Are they? I mean, you know, there is a long and there's a lengthy tradition of blackface in Canada and up until very recently.
But most people know it's not acceptable anymore.
Do they? You look at a vice principal at Mayfield Secondary School out in Caledon, Ontario. His name was Lionel Klotz. And just a few years ago, I think it was like 2014 or 15, something like that, comes to school dressed as Mr. T with like the Mohawk wig on, but then paints himself in blackface. Or, you know, the perennial conversation that gets had in Montreal, where there's a theater production or a TV production and somebody ends up in blackface. And then we have to have this conversation all over again. Like, have we really separated ourselves from it? Do we have enough temporal distance from the popularity of blackface that we can really have these conversations? Or do we have this like trickling effect of people who try to bring it back and try to be subversive and try to get away with it, which then forces us to have this conversation like it was the first time we've ever had it?
What percentage of people do you think understand the history behind blackface that you just explained?
Very few. It wasn't taught to me in grade school, high school, et cetera. It wasn't taught to me. I didn't even learn this stuff in university. I had to learn it through my own studies. I had to learn it by speaking to scholars. I had to learn it by, working alongside historians. Like, this is not stuff that gets taught to you in school. And I think in Canada, it's especially egregious because, and I've said this before, we grade ourselves in relation to other countries. So we don't talk about the history of slavery in Canada. We don't talk about the history of segregation in Canada. We don't talk about the history of black exclusion in Canada.
No, we just think that we're better than other countries.
Right, because we like to talk about the Underground Railroad. Yeah. You know, we like to define ourselves in relation to how bad everybody else is doing. We did this in the post-World War I period where we basically said, oh, man, Europe is a complete mess right now, but we're okay. And we our foreign policy was based on the solitude of being separated from all of this conflict by two oceans. You know, we talk about ourselves in relation to how bad the United States is because we didn't have widespread slavery here. We just had like a pinch of slavery, like a little tiny portion of slavery. And yet we have, you know, monuments to Confederate heroes in Quebec. You know, we had a prime minister that was sympathetic to the lost cause. One of the reasons that we can't ever get past this stuff is because we don't study it in the first place. I didn't learn it in school, which means I know a lot of other people are not learning this stuff in school, which means we're just doomed to have this conversation forever.
This is supposed to be why we have Black History Month.
Here's my problem with that. The origins of Black History Month, that is Carter G. Woodson's book, The Miseducation of the Negro, and his activism towards a more wholesome understanding of the contributions that Black people have made throughout history. Black History Month was there to highlight successes and create conditions for improvement. The whole uplift mentality of Black power in the in turn of the century America was almost entirely about understanding our historical contributions. What that has turned into over time is reconciling ourselves with historical atrocities that were committed against Black people.
Mm-hmm.
And I think we've so heavily conflated the two, I think especially in the post-civil rights era, that Black history has been replaced with atrocity against Blacks. And those conversations, to me, ought to be reserved for the rest of the year. Those are conversations that white people need to have with one another. Those aren't conversations that Black people need to have with white people because we understand them on a personal basis. You could hardly find a Black person who exists in this side of the world whose own family, whether it's one or two or three generations back, hasn't experienced that atrocity to some extent. Understanding our place in history, sure, we can have that conversation in February, but conflating it with all the terrible shit that you all did to us, sorry, that's a conversation for the rest of you to have for the rest of the year.
Do we get better every time we have this conversation?
I hope so. I don't know. Part of the reason that I do the writing that I do and the work that I do is because I hope to lay bare some of these historical wrongs and try to make things better. I don't know if it is making anything better, to be perfectly honest. And that's not me just trying to be cynical and hopeless. It's just because if it was, then why does this continue to happen every single year?
Thanks, Andre.
Thank you.
Andre Demise, writer, podcaster, part-time historian. That was The Big Story. For more from us, we are at thebigstorypodcast.ca and we are at frequencypodcastnetwork.com. You can find all of our shows there. You can also find them on social media at Frequency Pods on Twitter and on Facebook and at The Big Story FPN on Twitter. And of course, as always, we are everywhere you get your podcasts, whether that's Apple or Google or Stitcher or Spotify or Overcast or Podwalk. I'm Jordan Heath Rawlings. Claire Broussard is our lead producer. Ryan Clark is our associate producer. And Aliza Nielsen is our digital editor. Stephanie Phillips is our research assistant/chase producer/everything else you need. Thanks for listening. We'll talk on Monday.